Ayes, oye, the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert N. Davis presiding. All other business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Chief Judge Davis. To my right is Judge Greenberg. To my left is Judge Allen. We are here today in the matter of Dixon against Shulkin, docket number 081475. And the issue before the panel is whether the court may award Equal Access to Justice Act fees and expenses for attorneys' pre-litigation work in establishing that equitable tolling was warranted, which was work that occurred prior to the court addressing the merits of the claim. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Good morning, Your Honor. Tom Stover from the law firm of Arnold and Porter K. Schuller on behalf of Karen Davis, the appellant.
Thank you.
Ronan Morris with the Secretary, with Ms. Sarah Tia.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Stover, is Davis in addition to the name of Dixon?
I'm sorry, what did I say? Did I say Karen Davis?
You did.
I apologize.
I just
Karen
happened
Davis.
To be particularly sensitive to the name Davis.
Thank you for being sensitive to that, Your Honor. I apologize to the court.
No
Karen Dixon is
Dixon.
The name of
Dixon. Okay.
Thank you.
Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
And each party will have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I've informed the clerk that I'd like to reserve 20 minutes for rebuttal.
20 minutes?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Stover, you may proceed.
Thank you, Judge, and may it please the court. I really just want to make 2 points this morning. The first is a simple one. The argument that the Secretary makes about the form of our billing, the so-called block billing, and about the billing judgment that was used in filing the application here are both really red herrings. And I say this because in another case, a case before this court called Bustamante, that we litigated last year, my law firm, submitted an Equal Access to Justice Act application for fees in that case. The Secretary had no problem with the form of the billing in that case, and it was identical to the form of the billing in this case, and had no problem to the billing judgment that was used in that case. And again, it was me applying my judgment about what was appropriate for an Equal Access to Justice Act application. So I would submit that given the lack of any objection in Bustamante on bills that were the same in form and used the same billing judgment, there really is no issue here. It might be useful for the court to know that in the Bustamante case, we billed about 15 and a half hours a month. In this case, we billed about 18.2 hours a month. In the Bustamante case, I wrote off 35% of the hours that we billed before we submitted our application to the VA and to this court. And in this case, we wrote off 40% of the hours billed before we submitted our application to this court. In the Bustamante case, we briefed the case once to this court. We received an opinion without an argument. The case was remanded to the BVA. In this case, we briefed the matter at least three times to this court. twice to the Federal Circuit and then argued it twice before the Federal Circuit. So, again, I go back to the notion that questions about the form of billing that we've submitted for this application, the billing judgment that was used in submitting this application, really are a red herring. I think that the real issue here is the issue that Chief Judge Davis noted at the outset, and that is the Secretary believes, and this is my second point, the Secretary believes that the Equal Access to Justice Act should not allow for fees when litigating the question of equitable tolling. Now, Chief Judge Davis, you characterize that as pre-litigation, and I disagree. This court
respectfully disagrees.
Yes, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. Thank you for that correction. I respectfully disagree. This court's jurisdiction is a subject of litigation. And I think that if the Secretary's position undermines the purpose of the Equal Access to Justice Act, as set forth by Congress, the United States Supreme Court, the Federal Circuit, and this court. All of those courts and Congress have made it very clear that, and I'll pardon me for using the acronym EJA, that EJA exists to level the playing field between the government and individuals who are litigating against the government. And if the Secretary's argument is accepted, it will have the effect of chilling litigation in this court, and it will have a disproportionate impact on veterans who are physically disabled, who are mentally ill, who are homeless, who are incarcerated, or who do not have the means to retain a lawyer on their own.
Mr. Stover, I'm going to tip my hand here and say that, you know, I tend to agree with everything you just said. And I'm sure Mr. Wedge will tell me why I'm wrong when he gets up. But here's the question I have. So the last part of the relevant portion of EJA talks about whether there are special circumstances that make an award unjust.
Right.
So, which is sort of like other duties as assigned in a job description, because it sweeps in the extraordinary situation. So if you look at the history of this case, there were some sort of oddities that perhaps were generated less by the Secretary, and certainly not your client, and perhaps by some decisions of this court that might have been a different course of litigation than normal. What would you say to the argument that in that situation that might provide some pause about saddling the United States with that cost?
Two responses to that question, Judge Allen. The first is that I think the case law around the question of special circumstances really looks to the behavior of the litigant, him or herself. I have not found any cases, and I don't believe there are any cases that are cited by the government, that look to sort of the general kind of atmosphere around a case and say, well, this was a weird case because of a decision by the court or because of something that happened outside the control of the parties. I'm not aware of any case that would consider that situation to be special circumstances such that EJA would not apply. That's my first response. My second response is there are a couple of things that I think all of us in the courtroom can agree on. First is that equitable tolling did apply to Mr. Dixon's case, and the clock for filing his notice of appeal should have been stopped such that his notice of appeal was timely filed when it was submitted. That's something that the government has stipulated to and agreed to. That's something that the court has held. The second fact that we can all agree to is that there was sufficient error in the record before the BVA that the government agreed to a remand in this case. Now, both of those things, both of those agreements, could have been made in November of 2012 because no facts in the record changed between November of 2012 and the stipulated remand in 2016. So if the government had said in November 2012, we agree, we've seen what Dr. Kilpikowski, Mr. Dixon's psychiatrist, has to say, we agree that the doctrine of equitable tolling should apply here, and we also see in the record that there's a problem and it ought to go back to the BVA for further consideration, we wouldn't be here today. But the government didn't do that. In fact, what the government did, what the Secretary's counsel did, is prevent us from accessing Mr. Dixon's files, affirmatively misrepresent the scope of the TUI regulations such that we could not get the testimony from Mr. Dixon's own psychiatrist, forcing us into litigation in this court. Judge Castle rendered his opinion, rightly or wrongly. We took it up to the Federal Circuit. The Secretary did not confess error at that point. We litigated it at the Federal Circuit. The Federal Circuit made it very clear that the Secretary's position was absolutely untenable. We came back to this court. The Secretary then confessed that equitable tolling should apply. When Judge Castle refused to apply the doctrine of equitable tolling on the theory that the court could override a waiver by the Secretary, again, rather than confessing error, which the Secretary has the ability to do, the Secretary chose to defend Judge Castle's decision before the Federal Circuit. So it's our position that those choices made by the Secretary to litigate this case at every stage really is the reason that we're here.
Well, if I may, why should we get into all of this back and forth? Why not just hold that Congress intended that every lawyer should be paid for the reasonable value of their services for the work they did on behalf, in this case, of a veteran? Why do we have to go back and forth as to who was right or who was wrong on taking an appeal, defending an appeal? As long as you meet the three prongs of the statute, isn't that what we're called upon to deal with? A, did you file your application within 30 days? B, was the government's position substantially unsustainable? I've forgotten how the statute. And third, are your fees reasonable? Why can't we rule that way?
You absolutely can, Judge.
Now, if I may, and I don't mean to. I'm sorry, Judge Allen, had you gotten your answer?
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
But if I may just come back to your point number one. Remind me, what's the government's objection to your so-called block billing? Forget Bustamante. What's the problem here?
The answer is I don't know, Your Honor.
Well, tell me how you billed. I spent 45 years keeping 15-minute increments of my life in a computer. So what's the problem?
We bill in 6-minute increments, Your Honor.
That's ridiculous. But, of course, it's everyday life now. I understand.
Judge, I mean, we submitted our bills with the amount of time spent, the narrative of what was being done, and for our expenses, exactly what we paid and what we were paying
well,
for.
Well, what's the government object to?
It's a good question, Your Honor, and I honestly don't know, because the government really didn't address that in the course of their briefing. What they asked the court to do was to say, if you're going to allow Arnold and Porter to recover its fees in this case, then we ask for a second round of briefing so that we can challenge the specific line items. I think that there was some mention in the government's brief about the fact that Frontier Airlines now requires us to pay $30 to get a seat assigned when we fly from Denver to Washington, D.C. to argue in the Federal Circuit. And I think they billed me for a bag that I checked. There was some argument about the Westlaw and Lexus charges being inappropriate.
In all seriousness, shouldn't this come to an end here once and for all, obviously with the right to appeal to the Federal Circuit and beyond? But shouldn't we as a court consider your fee, your affidavit of services? It is an affidavit of services, isn't it?
It's an affidavit describing what the billing records are, Your Honor, and attaching the records.
And would it not be appropriate for this court to say, look, we'll grant what you've applied for as being reasonable and consistent with the statutory intent, or here's a number that's less than that.
And
we're entering judgment in favor of the law firm for that amount. You can take an appeal if you don't like it.
Yes, Your Honor. I think both of those things are absolutely what the court can do and what I would encourage the court to do. And I would say this. When I received the brief from the government, and read through it, at the end of the brief, the government says, well, gee, and Mr. Stover never even reached out to us to have a conversation about this bill. I immediately picked up the phone and called Mr. Morris, and I said, Mr. Morris, you know, I'd love to have a conversation with you about it. If you think there are things in this bill that we need to cut out, please tell me what they are. And I was told, you know, very seriously, very directly, very frankly by Mr. Morris, and I credit him for this, that's not really the issue for us. The issue for us is whether or not the Equal Access to Justice Act applies to litigation about equitable tolling. And I would say again, it has to, because consistent with all of the courts and Congress, they make it very clear that the Equal Access to Justice Act exists so that individuals like Don Dixon and later his widow Karen Dixon can litigate against the government without fear of bankrupting themselves, without fear of, you know, losing everything. And in this case, they had a substantially justified argument that ultimately prevailed and could have prevailed in November of 2012 if the Secretary had simply taken a look at the record and agreed to those things that he subsequently agreed to in 2014 and then in 2016.
Counsel, I've added 5 minutes to your time, and I'll give opposing counsel the same latitude as well. But let me follow up on Judge Greenberg's question. In your ideal world, let's say the court agrees with everything you say in your brief and decides that attorney fees should be awarded. Would that be something that you would be willing to discuss with the government regarding a resolution of the amount?
Just as we did in Bustamante, Your Honor, the answer is yes.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
There are no further questions, and I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Morris, if you need additional time, you may have it.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Your Honors, with the Court's indulgence, before we get into the more nuanced issues, there are four very quick points that I would like to make because I believe that they are critical to establishing the context in which the legal issues here need to be viewed. The first, Your Honor, is that the EJA applies to the litigation of the government conduct on which the civil action is based. In this case, the government conduct was the Board's denial of benefits. Equitable tolling was entirely unrelated to that. Second, Your Honor, the EJA is meant to deter abusive and unlawful government conduct. No government conduct caused or contributed to appellant's failure to file his notice of appeal within 120 days of when the Board decision was mailed. Third, Your Honor, the EJA does not exist in a vacuum. It is simply unreasonable to believe that Congress intended to remove the financial barriers to seeking redress against the government for those individuals that Congress explicitly barred from seeking such redress against the government in the first place by operation of its 120-day filing deadline. And fourth, Your Honor, and perhaps most important to the context, the EJA, as recognized by the Supreme Court down to this Court, is a limited waiver of sovereign immunity, which means that it must be strictly construed and strictly construed in favor of the government. So it's not the Secretary's burden here to demonstrate that Congress intended specifically to exclude equitable tolling litigation from the reach of the EJA, but rather it is the appellant's burden to show that Congress clearly and unambiguously intended for litigation over equitable tolling.
But if you don't mind, may I go to your point three? Don't we have the Supreme Court twice, once in Scarborough on this particular statute and on Henderson on the 120-day rule, taking a contrary position to the one you're advancing?
With due respect, no, Your Honor. The point was made both in the context of did Congress intend by the EJA to protect those veterans that Congress explicitly barred from seeking redress against the government, and it cannot be read into the EJA that Congress intended something that it also precluded. While the Supreme Court found that the 120-day deadline wasn't jurisdictional, that goes to the ability of the court to hear a case. It does not go to whether the appellant has a right to file that appeal in the first place. The appellant still didn't have that right to pursue his appeal, to seek that redress against the government, until the court decided that it would apply equitable tolling and allow the appellant to proceed.
Which we did.
Which you did, but it wasn't until June 16, 2016. And it was only on that date that the appellant was able to seek that redress against the government for the alleged misconduct, which was the Board's denial of benefits, and that is what the EJA is intended.
No. I didn't mean to be confusing. Back in Beauvais, following Henderson, we allowed these cases on an individual case-by-case determination. just happened that Judge Castle was reversed twice by the Federal Circuit. But what's that got to do with the veteran saying, I'm properly here from day one, thanks to Henderson? Or you should apply the concepts of Henderson to me, the veteran.
Because Henderson and the concept of equitable tolling is something that applies within the discretion of the court. It is not an action taken by the Secretary, nor is it an action that the Secretary could have prevented. And while Your Honor is right that this court had allowed it, telling in terms of the history of this case was that Bove had specifically indicated that the Secretary couldn't waive the quote-unquote jurisdiction elements and at the time, which was the law at the time, and that is what went to the Federal Circuit the second time.
So you're saying it took the Federal Circuit to come to its conclusion in this case for the clock to start running on attorney's fees in EJIA?
Respectfully, not the Federal Circuit, but for this court, yes. Until this court accepted the appellant's appeal as timely filed, the appellant did not have the right and the court could not undertake the actual review of the merits of the board's decision.
And you say that's June of 2016.
I believe it was
my
June
date
16.
Has it June 16, 2016.
That's correct, right. Your Honor. And telling Your Honor, to respond to one of the points that the appellant raised, the appellant indicated several times that the Secretary could have resolved this in November of 2012. That's the point. The Secretary couldn't have. There was no forum within which the Secretary could have resolved this until June 16, 2016.
So if I can interrupt, because I think I understand your argument, and really it's all about, to use my metaphor, when you flip over the hourglass, right? At what moment in time does the stand start to run? I think the appellant's point is that happens upon the filing of the document that is a notice of appeal, whether timely or not, that turns the hourglass. I think your position for the Secretary is that that doesn't happen, right? The game is not afoot until the court resolves whether or not the notice of appeal is timely. Do I have that right?
Correct. Because the EJIA is intended to deter unlawful and abusive government conduct, because the EJIA is related directly to the government conduct on which the civil action is based, it has to be at that moment when the review of the board decision is actually appropriate and can be conducted by the court that starts the litigation for purposes of the EJIA.
I understand the argument, but the problem I'm having is I haven't been able to find anything in sort of EJIA land out there that would suggest that that a civil action, right, the language of the statute, commences at any other time other than the filing of a particular thing. So, for example, in a district court, it commences with the filing of a complaint. Now, what about a situation where you file a complaint against the government, and the government says, no, you're out of time. Your statute of limitations have passed. And there's litigation over that question that isn't resolved for a year. I haven't been able to find anything to say that civil action hasn't commenced still upon the filing of the complaint, even though there was a question about whether it was too late. So are you aware of any law that supports this position?
My answer to that is twofold. I'm not aware of any law that supports this position because I don't believe that it is something that has actually arisen. And the context here is very different than in a federal district court, which, yes, Your Honor is right, and I believe the Secretary noted it in his pleading as well, that the civil action in district court starts with the filing of the complaint. And in Your Honor's example, the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense to be used by the defendant, and it exists to protect the defendant from stale claims. So it is something that the defendant has the option of raising an affirmative defense. This is not an affirmative defense. This is a congressional statute that sets the bar for when an appellant can file a claim in this court. And it's not something that's to be used, that's directed towards the Secretary, but rather it is something to a procedural aspect of this court's ability to hear cases. So I believe that they're very distinct. And the fact that there are no cases which would support the appellant's view does
in my opinion, does go to whether Congress clearly and unambiguously intended for proceedings that are necessary simply to have the proceedings over the government's conduct occur, whether they would be related. It can't be that Congress clearly intended those proceedings to be covered by the EJIA, because, again, they're not proceedings which in any way implicated government conduct. The purpose of the EJIA wouldn't be furthered by it. And, again, these are appellants or intended to be appellants who Congress specifically barred by a statute. The statute itself has no exceptions. And so, again, it is only by operation of judicial equity, judicial relief, that the appellant was able to have his claim heard. And prior to that date, there was nothing that the Secretary could have done. And, Your Honor, with due respect, the Secretary's position is that we do have to look past simply the word any civil action to the statute as a whole, to the various components of the statute. One of those components is substantial justification. The award will be given to the prevailing party unless the position of the government is substantially justified. Substantial justification is an offset provision. It's a clear indication that the government is permitted to offset the totality of its liability. There was not, which means that the liability should be commensurate with what the Secretary can argue was substantially justified. The Secretary, again, could not have done anything to eliminate the litigation that occurred prior to the court's acceptance of the appellant's appeal. The Secretary didn't cause the appellant not to file his appeal within the statutory period. And, in fact, even looking historically at the procedure, the Secretary didn't take steps at odds with any of the appellant's rights, and the Secretary would stand by the positions that he took throughout the course of the litigation, both at this court and in the Federal Circuit.
What was the thought process, though, of the Secretary in having accepted equitable tolling at this court and then not at the Federal Circuit? Now, I understand there was a change of lawyer in from the Department to the Department of Justice, right? But that seems like an odd part of this history.
I'm sorry, that the Secretary...
Well, the Secretary here, the second time we were back at the court, said, yep, equitable tolling applies and this person actually qualifies. Now, Judge Castle rejected that. But then you went to the Federal Circuit on the appeal, and one would have thought the Secretary would have said, yep, equitable tolling applies and this person qualifies, because that's what we just said. But the Secretary took an about-face to defend the judgment.
With due respect, I don't believe that the Secretary took an about-face. At the time that the Secretary effectively waived the equitable tolling issue, the law of this court was Bove, which specifically said that the Secretary couldn't do that. So what the Secretary said was the Secretary conceded that the elements at that point, given that the evidentiary record had been expanded, that those were met. The position that the Secretary took at the Federal Circuit was that this court should nevertheless have the independent authority to make that determination. And so that is not the same as the Secretary going back and saying the equitable tolling was no longer met or that the Secretary didn't waive it. And that certainly was a reasonable position to take, that given that Congress created the 120-day deadline specifically directed towards the court's ability, that for the Secretary to take the position that the court can still independently assess that, especially given its own case law, I don't believe that that was an unreasonable position by any means.
Well, what's wrong with the proposition that Congress intended through the Equal Access to Justice Act? I think that was enacted right around the time this court was created. Wasn't it? It was all 1989 time frame. What's wrong with the notion that Congress intended deserving litigants, including a particularly deserving class of litigant, veterans, to have their attorneys compensated for all the work, all of it, that was done consistent with the requirements of the statute? In other words, I would say what's wrong with starting with November 9, 2007, when the board denies the claim, and all the work from then on should be compensated if ultimately they prevail. What's wrong with that?
My response is twofold. First,
never mind what Judge Castle did. Apparently did it wrongly. Never mind what the Federal Circuit did. You could have applied for cert. Did the government ask for cert on or did the appellant ask for a cert on the Federal Circuit determinations? Either side.
I don't believe that the Federal Circuit determinations were in favor of the appellant. The first Federal Circuit determination was simply on a denial of a motion for an extension of time to file a motion for reconsideration of the denial of a motion to recall mandate. That was what went to the Federal Circuit the first time. And on the second time, it was after the Secretary had already conceded that equitable tolling was met, but nevertheless took the position that on the appeal, because Judge Castle had determined independently that it wasn't met.
Yeah, but just to follow along, if you take the average government bad conduct, I'm using that as a broad kind of generic term, that was intended by Congress to be compensated for in terms of attorney's fees and expenses through EJIA, it starts with the filing of a complaint in the district court. Here we have, and there may be other administrative agency determinations, that it starts with something else, like the filing of a notice of appeal, in time or out of time. Those arguments are all relevant in Article III proceedings, administrative proceedings, and when we get here. So why should there be any distinction? This case started when the board said no, and the lawyers did their work from that day all the way through today, and they want to be paid for it. What's wrong with that notion, regardless of which way the wind blew or which detour was taken by the courts or the government or the veteran on the way up?
Because with due respect, Your Honor, that's a policy argument as to what the EJIA should do, not necessarily.
No. So you don't think it's a matter of statutory construction for this court to consider?
I do, and I believe that the statute has. I believe that the statute has to be strictly construed. But I also believe that that purpose of the EJIA, veterans were a deserving class long before Congress amended the EJIA to include cases in this veterans court. And in Jones v. Derwinski, this court en banc recognized that when it held that the EJIA didn't apply in this context, and that benevolent purpose of the EJIA was insufficient to overcome the fact that the EJIA had to be strictly construed. And so those same concerns, they existed before Congress amended the EJIA, and it didn't apply in this court. And those same reasons apply today, simply because it would there may be positives or net gains that could come out of extending the EJIA to litigants who are fighting over equitable tolling doesn't mean that that's what Congress clearly and unambiguously intended when it enacted the EJIA. Because, again, Congress also created a statute that barred claims from being filed after 120 days. And Congress didn't leave exceptions to that. And so while it may very well
But the Supreme Court had held that that notion was unintended by Congress. It wasn't jurisdictional because, as you recall, Justice Alito said it's put in the procedural section of the statute. And what about Justice Ginsburg in Scarborough? Their failure to say that the position of the government was unsustainable, even though they met the 30-day requirement, related back. Aren't these all matters that are typically for courts to decide?
Yes.
What did Congress intend?
Yes, that is precisely what is for this court to
decide. So there's no clear and unambiguous language that isn't subject to judicial review, is there?
It's the clear and unambiguous intent that's required. When reading the statute as a whole, did Congress clearly and unambiguously intend the EJIA to extend to litigation that did not arise from government conduct, that was not a separate cause of action against the government, that the government had no control of, and at a time during that entire period where the government could not have done anything to mitigate its liability? Just as much as the EJIA is intended to protect certain classes of citizens from abusive government conduct, built into that very statute is the ability of the government to mitigate that liability, to mitigate that damage. Why? Because this is money that is coming from the American taxpayers.
Okay, let's assume for a moment that we accept everything you're arguing, counsel. And let's also assume that it was the court's mistake. What happens to the EJIA application in that case?
If it was the court's mistake, then unfortunately, it's the same outcome.
How does that square with the policy for EJIA and veterans?
Because the primary policy of the EJIA is to ensure no abusive or abusive government conduct or unlawful government conduct. If it was the court's mistake, and that again is not a separate cause of action against the court because Congress hasn't waived the sovereign immunity of the court system in that regard, then clearly Congress didn't intend for it to be compensated. And, Your Honor, and with due respect, this was pro bono representation. This was representation that was taken after knowing that the appellant had missed a statutory deadline. And to the extent that Your Honor, you know, are focused on the lack of law, perhaps, that supports the Secretary's position, I would note at the very least that in Sullivan v. Hudson, which clearly regarded a very different type of situation, but telling in that case was the court's finding that the post-remand proceedings were intimately tied to the resolution of the judicial action. Intimately tied to the resolution of the judicial action. The equitable tolling in this case had nothing to do with the resolution of the judicial action, which was the review of the
ultimately,
decision.
You don't think so?
Okay. It was a condition precedent to it. Right. It was required in order for the court to engage in the resolution, but right. It itself had no bearing on the outcome of whether the board's decision was proper or improper.
Okay. Let me ask you two questions, one involving the conduct of the VA. I guess it's in Denver, maybe, and the other involving how you reconcile your position with the Gene case. Let's go to the first question first regarding the conduct of the VA that Mr. Stover alluded to in the appellant getting access to information to pursue the claim. What happened, and why did it happen?
It is, Your Honor, it is unclear why it happened. And I realize that it's probably not the full response that Your Honor is looking for, but I would say two things to it. That conduct of VA was never actually litigated, so we don't have a full record as to what VA happened. The only time that that came up was, again, on the appeal of the denial of the extension motion itself. So that question was never litigated between the parties, and certainly it was never found to be unlawful conduct, and to the extent
well,
that...
Well, part of it was... Right, the VA's position that the Tucci, I'm mispronouncing that for certain, regulation applied was found by the Federal Circuit to be entirely baseless, right?
It was found to be unreasonable. But again, we didn't litigate. The Secretary of the Government was never provided the opportunity to offer his explanation as to why any of those events occurred. In fact,
well, couldn't you have said something about the regulation, not you personally, but the government, at least the regulation on appeal to the Federal Circuit? And also, I mean, if I remember right, the story of the conduct in Denver, of the not copying and watching over somebody, you know, that story was laid out. The government would have had a position that it could have taken at the time.
With respect, it wasn't germane to the outcome of the Federal Circuit's decision, and the Secretary had no reason to either defend or look further into it. The question before the Federal Circuit was whether this court had effectively had the authority to interpret its own rules of procedure, because the issue was whether, as this court, Judge Castle, found that augmenting the record for purposes of a motion for reconsideration was inappropriate, and this court did that based on its rules of procedure. That ultimately was the position that the Secretary took, was that this court certainly had the authority to interpret its own rules of procedure. The question as to the government's conduct was irrelevant to the disposition of that position and the disposition of the Federal Circuit's decision. So, yes, it did become a part of the record that the Secretary's actions, the agency personnel, were unhelpful, to say the least. But, again, it wasn't a litigated position. But beyond that, it's also legally irrelevant to the issue here, because even still, if that was conduct which would have given rise to a cause of action, then that is a separate cause of action, not a cause of action related to the review of the board's decision. So were the EJA to extend to any of the litigation concerning what the agency personnel did or did not do, that would have been a separate cause of action. And so in this context, and it certainly wasn't conduct that was found to give, it was not the conduct which gave rise to the appeal in this case. In fact, it postdated the attempt to appeal. And it was not a part of the Secretary's litigation position regarding the matter which was appealed, which was the board's decision. So as unfortunate as it might have been, again, to the extent that it did rise to the level of conduct that would have given rise to a cause of action, that simply was not the cause of action at issue in this case, which was the board's denial of benefits.
Mr. Morris, as usual, you're very very good with arguing the government's position, and I appreciate that. But you know something more is coming, right? with that compliment comes another question, and that is, if you look at Gene, what, as I understand your position, and I think that's a an interesting argument to make. But as I read the cases, I haven't found any cases, and I think Judge Allen has mentioned this, Judge Greenberg has mentioned this, that really divide up the litigation posture in the way that you're asking the court to do. You have no case that supports that position on dividing up the litigation posture, and Gene actually goes in the opposite direction. Gene says, in essence, on page 159 of the opinion, that there is one threshold determination for the entire civil action, and this is indeed a civil action. And where that civil action starts, it seems to me, to make sense, is when the NRA is presented to the court, just like when a complaint is presented to the court. So can you square that position with your position with Gene?
Yes, and I think several points related to several of the points that you made in there. But first, Gene assumed that the and rightfully so in that case, that the matter that was being disputed was something that the EJIA otherwise would reach to. It wasn't a dispute as to whether the EJIA would compensate for it. It was whether a second substantial justification defense could be raised. And in that context, it was specifically whether fee litigation, the government could raise a substantial justification analysis there. And it was only in that specific context that Gene held that a single substantial justification what was all that was needed. So again, Gene didn't touch on what the EJIA actually covered. It simply assumed that the EJIA was covering it, and it wouldn't be much unlike discovery or motion practice or something of that nature. That is what the fee litigation would be analogous to. But again, there are cases, and this doesn't come up frequently because this is a very unique situation. Because again, in a federal court, the complaint is filed, and matters such as statute of limitations are affirmative defenses that the defendant can but does not have to raise.
But to follow up with Gene, because it's hard to think about how one can read that case and then subdivide it in the way, at least, that the government suggests. So instead of a statute of limitations, what about a situation in which there was a question of subject matter jurisdiction, something that is unwaivable? Right? So
and always raisable.
And yes, and it almost rhymes, Judge Greenberg. But the point being that we litigate for a long time whether there's subject matter jurisdiction. And then ultimately the court determines that there is. I just think it's a real hard thing to say that the action doesn't really start for EJIA purposes until that event happens, right? And so that's the problem when you read Gene, I think. If we take the litigation as one unified whole, it's difficult for me to see why a rejected jurisdictional argument wouldn't count.
What Gene stood for was the idea of not piecemealing the fee litigation into sequential substantial justification analyses. But all of that pertained to the case during such time that the case could be heard and was reviewable and under the review of this court. This is distinct because, again, until the court accepted the notice of appeal as being timely filed, there simply was no case to be heard. The appellant could not proceed on the merits, and the government, the secretary, could not have sent that case back on the error. The government couldn't have mitigated its damages at that point. There was no forum. We could not have moved. Until the court accepted this, the government could not have moved to remand this case, as we did almost immediately after this court accepted the appeal. I mean, we served the record before the agency, and I think within 19 or 45 days afterwards, we contacted the appellant's counsel. This was before any briefing conference or any other substantive matters that occurred in this case. We could not have done that prior to June 16, 2016. In fact, we weren't even able to serve the record, and we didn't create the record at that time. let alone the ability to hear the merits of the arguments that the appellant might have had. So that is, I believe, also very distinguishable. The fee litigation intimately relates to the actual merits of the underlying litigation, as would the discovery motions or motion practice would relate to the actual merits, the ability to hear the case. And in all of those instances, the court has the authority to dispose of the case, or the parties have the authority to jointly dispose of the case. In the case of subject matter jurisdiction, until it's come up, then the same would hold true. And it's certainly not something that the government would even have to raise in that case. But this is a clear congressional statute, and it is the responsibility of the government to attempt to apply a government statute, and it's the responsibility of this court also to apply a government statute. There's been no dispute that the appellant did not satisfy that statute on its face. The appellant's ability to have his case heard was only because of a grant of judicial equity. And yes, that equity, the court has the authority to do that, because it is a non-jurisdictional statute, but it doesn't change the fact that the appellant didn't file his appeal within that 120 days.
Well, all right. Let's just accept your argument for the moment. Hypothetically, what's wrong? You're focused on until the Supreme Court in Henderson decided that the 120-day rule was not jurisdictional. Let's accept that for the moment. Well, what's wrong with compensating counsel for all the work done after that?
So my time is about to expire, but to briefly answer...
We've just added 5 minutes.
To briefly answer that, as a policy matter, there would be nothing wrong with it. But the question...
Well, I mean, are you on behalf of the government accepting that proposition?
As a policy proposition, or as a proposition that that was what Congress intended when it enacted the EJIA? Because no, it is the Secretary's position that Congress did not intend that, but moreover, that Congress clearly and unambiguously intend the opposite. That, yes, there are many reasons why it might make sense to allow the EJIA to extend to litigation over equitable tolling, but that's not at issue here, whether it should or should not. The question is whether it does or does not, whether Congress clearly and unambiguously intended it.
Let me ask you this. There is a statute that has litigation as part of it that goes back to 1871. It's 42 U.S.C. 1983. Should we look to that for an analogy? Fees compensated under, I think it's Section 1988 or 1986, I've forgotten. But that's civil rights litigation, usually as a result of state action. But fees are compensated, fees are awarded under the federal statute for all the wrong from the very beginning, regardless of what course the litigation takes. Discovery, appeals, reversals. Lawyers are entitled to be paid for everything. Why shouldn't that be the analogy we're drawing here? This veteran made his claim in May of 2008. He's outside the time limit of the 120 days for the decision from November 2007. But the lawyers have been working from that day forward. Why shouldn't they be compensated in accordance with congressional intent?
Because Congress did not expressly provide for that compensation, because this is a break from the traditional American rule, because this is a limited waiver of sovereign immunity, and because it's a limited waiver of sovereign immunity.
Yeah, but could Congress say that we're going to exclude the administrative process from compensation, or we're going to exclude litigation over whether the application of the administrative process was correct? Did it say we're going to exclude wrong-headed decisions by lower courts that have to be corrected by superior courts? No. Or did it?
I don't believe so.
Congress didn't put any exceptions in the statute, ones you're describing.
Right. Congress did not put any exceptions in the statute, and that is not something that should be taken lightly. Congress had every ability, if it wanted to amend the 120-day deadline, to add exceptions to the 120-day deadline, to allow the parties to litigate those between the parties. Congress could have removed that 120-day deadline, but Congress clearly established that deadline, and for reasons Congress was allowed to. Congress was allowed to draw that line, and yes, Congress's concern was clearly for those aggrieved veterans or claimants who were both aggrieved by government conduct, but also filed their appeals within the 120-day period.
Yeah, but Congress could also, this was not a matter of statute of constitutional dimension in Henderson. Congress, after 2011, could have amended the statute and said, we really meant it. 120 days is jurisdictional. But they didn't, did they?
But no, but again, there's a distinction between jurisdictional, the ability of this court to hear a case, and a bar to filing a claim, which is still what exists. But by finding that the statute wasn't jurisdictional, the Supreme Court didn't find that the statute was irrelevant. It is still a bar to an appellant's ability, and even reading the plain language of that statute, if a claimant is aggrieved by the decision, they have 120 days to file an appeal.
I understand, but here's the situation. We have cases all the time in this court in which single judges make determinations, panels make determinations based upon that single judge's ruling. We've got various determinations of this court and, in fact, of the Federal Circuit in applying particular cases under the 120-day rule. But in this case, here we are. We're at the end of the line. 120-day didn't apply, or equitable tolling should have applied. We held that it did. Why shouldn't the lawyer be compensated for all the work that led to that day when the veteran is entitled to be compensated?
Because, Your Honor, the EJIA is intended to shape government policy and government action, and there was nothing that the government could have done to prevent appellant from not filing his appeal within 120 days, nor was there anything that the government could have done to mitigate the extent of the court, the actions that occurred after that. The government could not have, especially at the time, waived equitable tolling, nor did the government challenge the appellant's once the evidence was added to the record that he didn't meet the criteria for equitable
tolling. Well, you said it's an affirmative defense. The government could not have asserted it if it didn't want to.
Counsel, your time is up. Could you add 5 more minutes to that, please?
What about that? Back in 2008. Affirmative defenses are affirmative. You have to prove it if you allege an affirmative defense. You have to raise it. What if you didn't raise it? What if you said, well, pay him?
Respectfully, Your Honor, my point was that this is not an affirmative defense. This is not a statute of limitations. Affirmative defenses exist to the benefit of the party that's going to raise it. So a statute of limitations exists to protect a defendant against stale claims where they may not have evidence, they may not have witnesses. This is not an affirmative defense. This is not a statute for the government to necessarily rely on. This is a statute that limits the flow of cases into this court. And whether that is there simply to expedite the proceedings, whether to benefit veterans as a whole by allowing a better process for this court deciding claims, that was Congress, and that has to do with Congress's purposes in enacting it. But that statute is not an affirmative defense statute. That is, it's not a statute of limitations. In fact, there is no statute of limitations affecting veterans' claims as a whole.
Mr. Morris, let me ask a question. Assuming that this panel unanimously is not persuaded by your argument, and we think that attorney fees should be paid, would you be willing to work with appellant's counsel to arrive at an appropriate, reasonable amount?
Were this court to find that EJIA applied to the equitable tolling portion of the litigation, then certainly the Secretary would negotiate with or sit down with counsel.
Okay. And I guess my final question is relating to the case law that I've read and your position overall. Do you think it is a good judicial resource allocation or even legal resource allocation to begin to parse and divide up civil action, which is the language of the statute, into pieces and then begin to make separate findings on pieces of that civil action? That's pre-litigation, post-litigation, mid-litigation. Does that make sense to you?
It's the Secretary's foremost position that the equitable tolling base is simply not a matter that is at all covered by the EJIA, in which case it wouldn't require any litigation over that. That which exists before the filing of the appeal and has no bearing on the merits of the appeal itself is simply a matter that is not within the reach of the EJIA. But to the extent that this court found that it was still within that same overall sphere, then yes, it would only be parsing it into two second sections. Again, one would be that which preceded the ability of the government to actually act on the alleged misconduct, and that which...
Like I said, I think it's a great argument, but do you have any cases that support that position?
Other than the extent to which those cases which do exist on the matter, all of them address the conduct and the positions of the government as they relate to the conduct on which the civil action is based. Okay. So while there may be no support for this position, because it's not a position that I believe has arisen in other jurisdictions, looking at those cases which do exist clearly refer to different contexts. And even the one case that the appellant cited, it was a District of Colorado case, it is entirely distinguishable in that that involved equitable tolling at the administrative level. So it was the agency itself which was debating the statute there.
Chief, could I ask one
question? Just before you sit down, because Mr. Stover talked about this, could you let me know what is the government's understanding of what the term block billing means? Because I will tell you that I didn't work as long as Judge Greenberg did in private practice, but I did work a decade at a large law firm, and you can bill in a block, but it's not block billing, depending on how you describe it. That's my understanding. So what is the government's understanding of that term?
I apologize. I'm not here with a clear position from the government as to what that does entail. I do believe that there has been case law which has suggested that hours, 3 or 4 hours at a time, would constitute impermissible block billing. But yes, I would agree that it has to do with more with the description of what is going on during that time rather than the specific amount of time in those cases.
Well, one of the government's arguments in the brief was that appellant's billing was block billing. Right.
Correct, Your Honor. And within the context of the general, what the Secretary believes was unreasonable as the fees, that was simply one factor and one part of that. I see that my time is finally expiring again. So thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Stover, we can add an additional 5 minutes to your time if you need it.
A couple of thoughts in response to what I heard Mr. Morris say this morning. The first is that the language of the statute, the language of the Equal Access to Justice Act, does not include in it anywhere the notion that the government has to engage in some kind of misconduct, nor is there any policy language which suggests that EJIA is designed specifically to prevent the government from engaging in misconduct. The language of the statute says very simply that the government's position must be not substantially justified. I don't think that rises to the level of misconduct, and we're certainly not here suggesting that the government has engaged in any misconduct in this case. I think that the second point I would make is that what I heard Mr. Morris saying several times was that the government couldn't be responsible for Mr. Dixon's failure to file a timely notice of appeal. And I have to say I feel a little bit like Yogi Berra. This is deja vu all over again. I've handled a number of equitable tolling cases before this court and before the Federal Circuit, and every time the government stands up, I hear them blaming the veteran. In this case, though, it is important to acknowledge that the government determined on its own that the criteria for equitable tolling was met. That means that the government has conceded that Mr. Dixon was prevented from filing a timely notice of appeal due to circumstances beyond his control, specifically the fact that he was suffering from severe mental and physical impairments, he required hospitalization, he was on strong medication, and so forth.
What date is that? Let's assume that that's so. What, and would you agree that's the date your time charge clock begins?
No, Your Honor, I would not agree
that.
It began before that, and I'll tell you why.
Well, what's the date it began?
The date it began, I entered my appearance, and that was August of 2012. In fact, I can tell you exactly, it was August 28th of 2012. That's the date the time clock begins.
Nothing before that?
No, Your Honor.
You're not seeking compensation for anything before that?
That is correct. Mr. Dixon was pro se before that. I want to go back to the sort of blame the veteran point because I think it's important. Mr. Dixon, the doctrine of equitable tolling applied because Mr. Dixon could not get his notice of appeal filed within the 120 days. The EJA makes it clear, and the case law that the Supreme Court, that this court, and the Federal Circuit have decided make it clear that this statute, the doctrine of equitable tolling, et cetera, is applied because the court has to err in favor of the veteran. And that's why there's nothing that Mr. Dixon did in this case. There's no fault on Mr. Dixon that would prevent EJA from applying here. The third point I want to make it goes back to Judge Allen's analogy with the egg timer. And I would modify that analogy slightly. And I would say instead of an egg timer, it's more of a chess clock. The decision in Checo makes it very clear that the 120 days doesn't run and then you get additional time after that. What happens is the clock stops running. And it stops running for that period of impairment and then starts running again once the veteran is sufficiently well to be able to appreciate the deadline and file a notice of appeal. And that's what happened here. So it's not as if the 120 days expired and Mr. Dixon missed the expiration date. What happened is the clock stopped running. And so, again, this is not a question of whether or not, you know, the government did something to prevent Mr. Dixon or didn't do something to prevent Mr. Dixon. It's just a question of the fact that equitable tolling makes it clear that Mr. Dixon, that the period of stopped running until he got his notice of appeal went on time.
Let me ask you this.
Yes, Judge.
Man. Your fee application is through January 2017.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you contend you're entitled to fees beyond that date?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And would those fees also be included in what the Chief Judge suggests would be subject to bargaining or negotiation with the government?
I am always happy to sit down with Mr. Moritz and his colleagues at the Department of Veterans Affairs to discuss what a reasonable amount would be.
But in any event, you believe you're entitled to an additional fee for the last year's worth of work leading to and including today, let's say.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
And we think that EJA is very clear on that, and the case law is very clear on that.
Mr. Stover, could I ask a question? This isn't exactly the government's argument, but let me try if I were going to be the lawyer on the other side. What about the notion here that this was equitable? In other words, this was something that, you know, going back in history was, you know, the mercy of the king sort of thing. And the argument being perhaps that unlike my analogy with respect to subject matter jurisdiction, where there either is or isn't subject matter jurisdiction, whether or not a body grants favor through equity is not the same sort of thing. How would you respond to that if we used that as a rationale to distinguish this from, say, the issues discussed in Gene?
Right. I think the answer to that question is going to be very case-specific. And, of course, EJA, the application of EJA is very case-specific. Every time it's applied, the court is directed to look at the specifics of the case. So addressing your question, and with due respect to Mr. Morris, who honestly wasn't involved in this case back in 2012 when all of these events occurred, I was. There is nothing in the record of this case that the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, through his attorneys, did not know on November 1st, 2012, that was added to the record that led to the conclusion that equitable tolling should apply. In other words, on the facts as they existed on November 2012, the Secretary agreed that equitable tolling should apply in this case 2 years later. And so my view is that if equity is really the issue here, then the shoe is sort of changed to the other foot now. because the government did not agree with us that equitable tolling applied in November of 2012, based on the testimony of Mr. Davis's psychiatrist, a witness who the Federal Circuit deemed was incredibly important to the determination of whether or not equitable tolling should apply. Because the government refused to agree at that moment, I think the shoe the burden shifts, if you will. And it's up to the government now to explain why they shouldn't be on the hook for fees in this case. Now, this goes back to a point that Judge Greenberg made a moment ago. Well, what about in June, I think it was, of 2016, when the government finally said, okay, we agree, equitable tolling applies. Pardon me, I said 2016, I meant 2014. In June of 2014, when the government says, okay, we agree, equitable tolling applies. I think at that point, you know, an argument could be made that the clock ought to stop running. And maybe it should stop running all the way through, except when Judge Castle issued his decision and said, I can, under the rules of this court, determine without respect to the government's waiver that equitable tolling shouldn't apply, rather than confessing error at the Federal Circuit, which is something that the government could have done, they chose to defend that decision. Now, there are several places in the government's briefing where they describe this as litigation between Mr. Dixon and the court. The court has never appeared as a party in this litigation. No one other than the Secretary of Veterans Affairs has ever been listed on the caption of this litigation. No one other than an attorney for the Department of Veterans Affairs or the Department of Justice has ever appeared for the government in this litigation. This is not litigation with the court. This has been litigation with the Secretary at every step. And I don't begrudge them that. That's their right. That's their due.
Well, they can't possibly be serious, can they? Because people appear in this court, it's litigation personal against the judges of this court? First of all, we have absolute immunity, I'm assuming. Secondly, that can't possibly be a logical interpretation of the statute, is it?
Your Honor, you put me in a difficult position.
Well, why?
A delicate position. Well, because I
just because some judge up here got it wrong and was corrected by a higher court, that happens right. All the time.
Right. And look, I agree with you. But that's the position that the government has taken. And I raise it only to say I think it has been very clear throughout from the beginning that the government has, in some cases unjustifiably, back in November of 2012, thrown up barriers to Mr. Dixon receiving the decision that the government ultimately agreed to, sometimes by simply submitting briefs to the Federal Circuit in support of Judge Castle's decisions in this case. The government has clearly stood in the way of Mr. Dixon and, sadly now, Mrs. Dixon getting her due before the BVA.
Yeah, but you're not arguing bad faith, for example, on behalf of the government, because I think those concepts in this case are irrelevant. It's you did the work from the date. Should you be compensated, or is there any bar to compensation in the statute or the intent of Congress as we find it?
You're right, Your Honor. We are not arguing bad faith, and we think the language of the statute is very clear. There is nothing in the statute that requires bad faith on the part of the government. There is nothing in the statute that requires misconduct. There's nothing in the statute that suggests that it exists to prevent bad faith or misconduct on the part of the government.
But the language does suggest that the government's position needs to be substantially justified.
And yes, Your Honor, it does. And we believe that the government's position in this case has not been substantially justified. Well,
let's look at that just for a moment, Mr. Stover. Because the Federal Circuit reversed the former chief judge's decision here, failing to grant a second motion for extension of time. And on remand, the Secretary conceded error conceded that the Bayer principles apply and that equitable tolling should apply, and waived their timeliness defense. Is that action reasonable? And I'll ask that in the context of the Checo case, which you mentioned, because the Secretary's position is that this issue, this question, this legal question, was open. Is that reasonable? Does that substantially justify the Secretary's position.
Not if you read the Federal Circuit's opinion, Your Honor. No, it doesn't.
Right.
I mean, I am a lawyer. I am a creature of the law. And when I read what the Federal Circuit did in both Dixon 1 and Dixon 2, I think it makes it very clear that the Secretary's position was not substantially justified in either of those cases.
And if I can jump in just on that, but that's actually your fallback position, if I understand it, right? Your initial position is, once we know that this begins, and so equitable tolling is part of it, the concession of error in the joint motion to remand would be sufficient to determine that the government's position wasn't substantially justified. I mean, I think I understand.
Yes, that. Your Honor.
And so Chief Judge Davis's question only comes if we essentially adopt the Secretary's position that says we have to have a separate substantial justification inquiry into the equitable tolling part.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree, and I would say that the Gene case suggests that no separate inquiry is required, that the case should be taken as a whole and not parsed out into arguments about jurisdiction versus arguments about the merits.
So, following on what Judge Allen said, you're agreeing that that's position number two, but you prefer position number one, which you've just articulated.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, and you think we'd be correct in making that determination?
I think you would be correct. I think you would be consistent with the holdings of the United States Supreme Court, the Federal Circuit, and prior holdings in this court. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
If there's no further questions, that's all I have. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you all. The case will be submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and greet counsel.